at the end of Bible class, they're all supposed to be in the room, right? No, they're all supposed to be in for the whole time in Bible class, because that's what you do in Bible class. They're not supposed to go anywhere unless you go in the bathroom, right? And that's scriptural, right? Is there any scripture that says you got to stay in the classroom the whole time? Or where did we get that from? If they need solitude, let's give them some solitude. Or maybe I send them some verses in the week, and I say, consider these verses on solitude. Hey, don't come to class. Experience some solitude. What do you think? I mean, if we're trying to get them to experience something and grow through something, why don't we allow them the freedom to do it? Right? You see the difference? See the difference here? A little creativity. Class on prayer. Hey, let's talk about prayer. You guys pray. Let's just go in here. You know what? I did this one time. I even made up this whole list of things to pray about. I thought, you know what? If we're going to pray for 30 minutes, they're going to need a list. And so I came out, I had this, like, all these Bible verses. I said, you can pray these Bible verses if you can't think of anything. And here's all of our sick, and here's all of our shut-ins. And I came to class, and we talked about prayer, and I said, you know, I have this list of things to pray about, but that almost seems a little overwhelming. Why don't you pray about what you need to pray about? Throw these away. No. Is this clicking? Okay. I can't necessarily just say, you have permission to run with all, and maybe there's a discussion you need to have, but I hope that your elders have enough foresight and wisdom and knowledge to know what's negotiable, what's scriptural, and what's not. These things are not scriptural issues. How we run Bible class is not a scriptural issue. And we just need to understand that. And then once we have that permission and understanding, then we can start doing things in that time that work. Because they've gotten a million Bible classes in their lives, and they're still very loosely connected. Right? So if we need to try something different, what are we going to do with that time? How are we going to think about that time? Does it make sense? Anybody?
Two of you?
Three, five, ten? Okay, come on. Okay, so we want a place where they can look in, a place of their own spiritual development. Spiritual discipline would be, except for serving, would be what? Looking in. Looking in is okay. The problem with the church is we spend all of our time looking in. Okay? We need to also have an environment where they're looking out. Looking in, looking out. It's kind of this cycle that we get in. Service to others inside the church and outside the church. The way we started this was just a monthly time of service. And eventually we ended up with some doing some leadership roles and delegated responsibility to let those in the group lead these types of things. So they look out through service. And then we look out through an intergenerational ministry approach. And some of you guys have asked me about this. One of our goals in our group was to not become an entity to ourselves, to not become an insulated, isolated, one more clique within the broader congregation, that all we know is each other, all we talk to is each other, all we care about is each other. No. There's going to come a point in time where they're not 20 or 30 anymore. And we don't want to see them, not just now they're bailing at 18, but now they're bailing at 40. Right? And so we have to start building those bridges. And you have to start building those bridges, that intergenerational connection, before you get there. Okay, so what do? You start giving them opportunity. You start giving them time. We had a series of classes where we brought in some people into the class to just talk to them. First class brought in our elders and elders' wives, a couple of our elders, and just ask them questions. They tell their story, and we start asking, what's it like to be an elder? What's been your biggest challenge, you know? And I've got my little list of my backup questions in case everybody's... They're not quiet. They got questions. And they're asking. And they're getting to see their elders, to hear their elders, to hopefully start to love their elders. Because how do you love somebody you don't really know? I mean, yeah, we kind of love them, but do we really love them? Do we know we love them? They have to have time to interact in order for this to happen. Had a senior brunch a little while back. And as I said before, we had times of encouraging people, don't come to our class. Please go to another class for a while. We need to get to know some other people in the congregation other than just our people. And I'm going to throw this one out there. I will say on the front end, we didn't do this probably well. It was too much, and we could have done a little better. And so it was too complicated, and it wasn't sustainable because of our model. I'll say that on the front end. But I just want to share this little aha with you. There was a point in time where we talked about the need for more outlets for living out the mission of Jesus within our congregation and within our 20s and 30s group. And so we decided to look at the ministry of Jesus and pull out who were the people, the different types of groups of people that he was spending his time with, serving, ministering to. And we came up with a list. And you got the hurting, you got the poor, and you got the sick, and those types of things, right? And so we split our ministry up into groups of people and said, you guys take on the poor, you guys take on the hurting, you guys take on the sick. And then each week, which was too much, by the way, we had one of those groups meet and plan an activity for that week that would cover somebody in the congregation or outside the congregation who was whatever their group was over. Okay? And so we started doing this. We did this for a couple months, and it just got to be overload, and there's too many people running, and it's too hard to conceptualize a little bit. It should have been more, less is more, is what it should have been, a little more spread. But here's the aha I want to share from that is, there was a class that, because our class was starting to grow, and we started filling up our room, and about this time, this is exciting to think about these things and to do them, right? And so the Sunday after we started implementing this, I got to class, and people, you know, sometimes we're a little late, and they're kind of filtering in. Well, the filter this week was really slow. I mean, people were just dragging in. I'm looking at my watch, man, where is everybody today? What's going on? They're not like me. Like, what's wrong? I'm insecure, you know? I mean, what's wrong? No, not really. But maybe I am. So I had this little aha, okay? Where I realized we had more people doing something in present that Sunday than we probably ever had. These guys were planning over, and they just weren't in class. And I, all of a sudden, the light bulb came on, and I said to myself, we have fewer people in class than we've ever had, and this is the best thing that could ever happen. Make sense? We've got people in the auditorium class, we've got people in this class, we've got three of these, some of our ladies were teaching the children that quarter, we got people planning to serve the homeless over, and it was like, wait a minute, I started adding everybody up, and I'm like, they're all doing something. Wait a minute, this is nuts. It is supposed to be this way. Isn't that cool? But we get caught up into this model of, they don't have to be in this room listening to a teacher and doing it, you know, and it's lovely to do that. You got to find balance. Just don't do it that way every single time for 18 years. Did you get what I'm saying? So I'm not debunking Sunday morning worship. I'm not debunking Bible class. I'm not throwing aspersions on the things we've done. I'm just saying we got to find some balance here, guys. It's making sense? We throw all the eggs in the worship basket or in the Bible class basket, and we have no outlets or avenues or opportunities. Don't present any of the mission of anything else for a lot of places. Or if we do, we just don't let people know very well. Okay? We've got to find that balance. What I'm talking about here is becoming more missional. But before I do that, I want to talk a little bit more about this intergenerational thing. What ends up happening in the congregation in the past has been, we have two churches that meet within your building. Remember that statement? If you have a Bible youth ministry, Eric Brown said, there are most likely two churches meeting under your roof on Sunday morning. Okay? And so you got church A and church B. But then you come along and you add in a 20s and 30s ministry, now you get church C. Right? And that's why I'm talking about in and out. You got to keep sending people. You got to keep that flow. You got to get people to know each other. You can't insulate and isolate. And so here's some things that we've tried. You want practicality? Okay, here we go. We lose them at transitions. The leap is too big. There's a guy named Ronald Heifetz who wrote a book called Leadership Without Easy Answers. He was a Harvard Business School professor. I don't know what he's doing now. The book's about 15 years old. And he talks about keeping people in productive tension. He says, if you don't turn up the heat enough, people just stagnate. If you turn up the heat too high, too fast, people bail on you, right? But if you can keep people in productive tension, they will grow. And I think we often fall into those two extremes. We either don't turn up any heat at all and people stagnate, or when people graduate high school and we say, hey, come on in, big church. We'll just turn the thermostat up to 500 degrees. And they say, I'm out of here. I can't sit in that pot, right? They're gone. And so we have to preemptively, beforehand, preventatively, start making that bridge, building that bridge. What does that look like? Our 20s and 30s ministry, we have begun sending people down. Here's the reason. Okay, if I want someone in that youth group to someday become a viable, active member of my 20s and 30s ministry, they have to know some people in there. How are they just going to one day wander into our 20s and 30s class and say, you know what, I realize that in about 10 years, I'm going to need to know some of you guys. So I just thought I'd go, you know, if someone says that, they're fine. Don't worry about that guy. He's going to be okay. They're not going to do that. Okay? So we start sending people down. We start sending some of our 20-somethings to teach the youth group for a while. We start sending them just to hang out with the youth group for a while. Just be in their class. Just get to know them. You know, talk with them. Encourage them. We send them into the college class to teach, to encourage, just be present. And guess what? After a few years, when those transitions start taking place, they're going to be comfortable, aren't they? Because when they get to that next level, in the next stage of their development, they're going to see people there who are familiar. And they're not going to jump ship because the relationships are there. So we have to think up and think down. Send people down to the people who we want to come up, and send them up to the people who are older. So one day, and even right now, we need people who are older in our lives to help us mature, grow, and give us perspective. And so many times, we really do a disservice to our young people by isolating them from some of the people whose perspective they need most. So we send up, and we send down. To be encouraged, to learn, to grow. And this is laying the foundation for future transitions. Is this making sense? Because I don't want these guys to get to a point of transition and not be ready for it. And it may take some years before all those pieces are in place, but we've got to start doing that. And if we want them to be in a certain part of the congregation, we've got to start making those relationships now. We can't wait. And when they jump ship, I mean, ask yourself why. Why did they jump ship? What happened there? Were they connected? Did we have them to begin with? Right? Is that a valid question? I know I've asked it like too many times now. All right. So we've already kind of gotten into being missional a little bit. How do we get more missional? Engaging and communicating authentic and impacting mission. It has to be visible. It has to be viable. And they have to know about it and be able to be engaged in it. I will say before I lay out some of this information that I think sometimes we can almost become addicted to application in the 20s and 30s generation. There was a time for me in my own thought process where to me, at first, when I first started teaching Bible class, application was a question. If I asked an application question, we applied that, right? So you get to the end of the lesson, and you say, well, how does this apply to you? How does this change your life? What are you going to do different? We applied it, right? And then we kind of moved to, instead of just asking a question and contemplating it, we said, why don't you do something about this? And then we moved from, well, let's do something. Let's do it right now. Right? Like meditating, silence, prayer, right? You see the difference between asking about it and saying, well, go home and do it. Well, by the time they get home, they've forgotten whatever it was they're supposed to do, to let's spend this time to be developed. But here's the danger in that is, that can almost become this addictive process that they start reading their Bibles, like, I gotta do something about it. Like, everything I find just becomes this impossible task. And so we have to be realistic about all of that. How do we get more missional? The temptation is to minister to them. I would encourage you to have a ministry of them and by them rather than just a ministry for them so that we can equip them to be ready to minister to others. Okay? Make sense? How do you do that? For us, and we have not done this perfectly, but we've attempted this and done it successfully at times. And sometimes it becomes natural and you don't need it as much as other times, but we try to delegate responsibility. And nuts and bolts, here's what that looks like. We get a group together, we talk to them, and we say, there's some responsibilities and some things that we need to happen. Who's interested? Somebody want to lead some service projects? You say, yeah, you know, we take that on. Okay, we'll lead January, February, March. You take those. We'll talk about that later. You have that responsibility. Here's your job description. That way they don't think they're going to do it forever, right? Isn't that the worst thing? You volunteer for something and you got to do it forever? Are you ever going to do it again? Yeah, I don't want to do it. So you tell them how long, you tell them exactly what you're expecting. Okay? And if they need help, yeah. Let's just come. Let me back up just a second. At first, here's what happened. At first, the temptation was for me just to do all this. I'm going to plan a service activity. I'm going to plan a social fun thing. I'm going to plan a devotional. And then I will invite them to come into what I plan. And that went okay. Whenever I said, you know what? Joe Smith, you coordinate a monthly devo for our 20s and 30s ministry for the next 3 months. Guess what happened? You know what? We had more people there. Why? They took ownership. And what did they do when they took ownership? Oh, yeah. When they're running it, what do? They invite their friends, don't they? they bring in people that, do I know all their friends? Do I know, you know, it's like, whenever I invite people, well, that's Matt, he's in the ministry, of course he's going to invite me, you know, but when these guys invite people, guess what, they come, right? So what we're doing is we're creating a ministry that's of them, not just something we do to them. You get the difference? Then they become invested in it and become equipped to do ministry themselves. So you give them roles, you give them responsibilities, and you help them to make it their own and rotate periodically who's in charge of that area. That way it doesn't become overwhelming. Another principle we try to implement at times, we've done better sometimes than others, is to have the old trend to do. Have the old trend to do. So if you were the Devo guy for a while, then the new guy comes on, you said, you guys talk it over. What worked, what didn't work, you work it out. You know what, I'm not going to just step in the middle of it and explain it all to you, you guys just talk it over. Okay? And guess what this becomes is, eventually this becomes something that if I get hit by a Mack truck or hard, hope their plane doesn't crash on the way back to St. Pete, you know, like this thing can continue on. Because it's not dependent in an unhealthy way on me to get everything done. And then of course service is the new front door. I don't know if it was Willow Creek or kind of who came up with turning the funnel upside down. You know, it used to be you would come to church and then you would start doing things with the church and getting to know people and forming relationships. And then eventually someday, as you got more mature, what you do? The very last step of involvement is serve. Right? But now, the funnel's been shifted. And service becomes the front door. The front door ministry. Why is that? Anybody? How is service the front door, an entry point into the congregation?
People feel like they're doing something important, like they're valuable.
Right. So if you give them a mission that's bigger than themselves, what are they going to do? Tell their friends about it. They're going to invite people to. Why? Because now we're doing something that's meaningful. Right? We're doing something that's meaningful. Yes, sir?
You don't have to speak church language to clean a house. Or serve soup.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Absolutely. And there's no better way to get to know someone than to serve alongside them, right? And they start developing connections with people who are inside the group. And then whenever you say, hey, would you like to come to Bible class? They say, what happened to some of those guys? I feel comfortable with them. Why did you serve with them? I mean, I didn't just say that to them, but I mean, that's what happened, right? And so it becomes an inreach for an outreach back into the congregation, the ministry, and a way to connect with other people. One thing that we've done in Northwest, some groups have done better than others, but we encourage our life groups to do service periodically. Couple times a year. So again, so that we don't become completely inward focused on our group. We start looking out to other people. We give them a voice. Give them a seat at the table. Nothing shows that you are invested in them more than to give them a voice in the decisions that are being made, especially in regard to them. Okay? And as I talked about a little while ago, you know, you read this principle in books on 20-somethings. You gotta listen to them. You gotta listen. Yes, you do. You really gotta listen to them. But when you do, sometimes it can be difficult. And you really have to love on these guys. You really have to love on these guys in order to make it through that process well. And again, I mentioned this before, but expanding our view of involvement. I think our view of involvement is too small. Sometimes we limit it to what happens on Sunday morning as official roles within the worship, the order of worship. Involvement is your name is on an item of the order of worship. Now you're involved. You lead a prayer. You pass communion. But that's too small. That is not the Jesus model of doing things. We have to give permission for people to do things outside of all of that. And when they goof up, we don't blast them, but we love on them. There's a lot of good news here, I feel like. There's a lot of good news here. I don't want to leave you with the feeling like, man, this is just too much work, and it's just, how are we going to tackle it, and where are we going to start, and all this stuff. I really want, at the very basis of it all, for you to understand that if we start reaching out to them, even in the simplest of ways, and we start being vocational to them, and start spending time with them, and start listening to them and loving them, it doesn't matter if you do all these things I'm mentioning just so, and cookie cut it, and all, oh, it all turned out pretty, we did it all just like a Tulsa, it's great. There's some really super basic things that you can start with to start showing these guys that they really do have belonging. Someone really does care for them. I mean, let me ask you this, how can the gospel be true if God's people don't show that they love them? Isn't that self-defeating? I mean, we're presenting this great message of love, but then they come into our midst and feel like nobody cares. how can our message be true? From their perspective, you get what I'm saying? As they experience it, that defeats everything we're trying to do if we don't show them that we love them, that they belong. What questions do you guys have here? We got one more session going. Any questions as we're talking through some of this?
What is a life group?
Life group. That's a small group ministry. Typically, churches will do that on Sunday night in place of at the building Sunday night service. And the idea behind that is in the book of Acts, a lot of the the temple and the homes were the central focus of the worship. And so, you know, that's another thing that we kind of get overwhelmed with. We think facility-wise, how are we going to do certain things? If you start looking at the facilities that we actually have at our disposal, we actually have a lot more space than we realize. We just have to have the freedom to see it that way and to use those things. And not every eldership would agree with me on that. I understand that.
Good idea.
Yeah. Okay. Any other questions? You have one, Jared?
Yeah, you mentioned you have a guy that was a first generation, 4 years, I believe, and then now he's a deacon. Could you walk through maybe that story, if you don't mind, to give people an idea of their background and how that worked, and just so that maybe we see how something like that might flow through your ministry?
Gotcha. There's a good story with those guys. His wife, had grown up in the church. Her grandfather was one of the founding members, 57 years ago of the congregation. She had become somewhat disconnected when we met him. They came to Missy and I for premarital counseling. They were going to get married. They were both kind of beginning to be disconnected from the church. And we kind of saw that premarital counseling time as an opportunity for us to get to know them and to reinvest in them and re-engage them back into the congregation. So in that counseling time, we kind of challenged them on a few areas in their life over time. We kind of get into the whole the living together before marriage and some of these issues that come up that was present in the situation. And I just throw a little word out on that because this is everywhere. You watch TV and this is what we do now. And that is the general idea, even within the church of many people. It's actually unusual for me to run into a couple. Even within Christianity, that's not living together if they're engaged. I don't know if that's, you guys experienced that or not. That's very unusual, unfortunately. And so we got to know them. We spent several counseling sessions talking to them, loving them, being welcoming to them. We knew this was coming. We knew we were going to have this conversation about that. And so we engaged in the conversation about them separating prior to their marriage. They were willing to do that because we knew that we cared about them and valued their marriage. And so they separated. And he began to become interested in the church for that process through the care that we showed to that couple. Even saying, when we told him, this is not easy for us to say that we love you enough to tell you this is what needs to happen for all these reasons, biblically, sociologically, everything else. I mean, it's pretty convincing. And so we started connecting with him. He started getting more involved in the church, started playing church softball, getting to know the guys, enjoying that. Finally started coming into the Bible class, small group, and ended up studying with him, baptizing him over the course of some weeks, actually maybe a couple, a month or so. And from that point on, it just became his faith. I mean, he's a first-generation guy. This is not anything his parents are handing to him, but he took it on as his own because I think he saw that the young adults around him were very serious about their faith and living that out and providing opportunity to experience that. And, of course, now he's leading service for our congregation, serving others, because I think that's what he experienced early on. It was valuable to him. So,
actually, what's really cool is he's had his mom now.
Yeah, his mom's coming.
Like, his mom's coming. Sometimes he gets into a group.
Right.
That's really neat to see.
Yeah. It's interesting to watch the children try to bring faith to their parents. It's kind of interesting. It's good. Any other questions?
I'll just say, you mentioned softball, and it kind of touched the button because that's helped bring me into the church, in that my wife was a Christian. She was taking our sons religiously to church, and they were having a good time. And I guess first thing the kids asked me, how excited I came, is, Dad, why don't you come? This is a lot of fun. So, of course, I went. And almost immediately, small community, so we all know each other and stuff, but we're they were having softball team, men's softball team, and some of the guys moved from playing baseball and stuff that I participated in all that, so they invited me in. The team was made up of all the way from guys maybe still in high school all the way up to people in their 30s and 40s and all that. And just the relationships so quickly developed there that then when I did start participating, you just felt right at home. You know, you had those relationships built. So, you know, I think just whatever, you know, you just have to try things out. But something as simple as that has brought other people into it. I mean, I saw other people come in that were not Christian, didn't attend, you know, participate with the church, and that kind of brought them in, made them feel at ease. Yeah. You know, aren't just going to be preached at and so forth.
Right.
Made them feel like they're just one of us. Yeah. We're all
absolutely
in this together and so forth. So,
and the guy we're talking about has then invited his friends to come play softball on the church team. You know, so we have about a 50-50 Christian, non-Christian mix on the softball team. Trying to reach out to some of those guys. The belonging is huge. I can't tell you enough. They're hurt. They want to belong. They're hurt. You don't take anything else home. Go home and help them not feel hurt and help them to feel like they belong. Comfort them, love on them, show them that someone cares. And you may not do everything just perfect, but don't forget a lot of that if they see that you're... I'm not saying there is a perfect way to minister to these guys. We've had enough bumps and bruises along the way to know.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Or you really did something the whole chase.
No,
you said that like you were going to tag something else.
Well, at least it would be some of those things that we're going to learn from how I live over here.
We're doing that.
I'm from Central Missouri.
All right, well, go ahead and get started. Thanks for being on, Darren. Good.
Hey, don't get that under that door. That's all I'm saying. They're going to try, and I know they will.
Oh, goodness. It's harder when you have a second story.
I'm on your cheek.
Sorry, sit over there. Hey.
I'm not sorry you can have it back. Sorry, sit over there.
I want to start by saying I appreciate you guys. I've just been to talk to some of you. It's really encouraging to hear what God is up to, and sometimes you kind of feel like you're the only one out there doing whatever it is you're doing and different things until you get with other people who are doing similar things and you find out that there's still so much to learn and there's still God's doing so many good things. And I think it's just really encouraging and incredible. And sometimes it's tempting to feel like it's all up to us, or until we get it just right, it's not going to fly or whatever. And we have to remember that we're really dependent on God to make this thing grow. First and foremost, you can't really even focus on strategies and techniques and how you do it like this and not like that unless God is at the center of the whole thing and we're completely dependent on Him. I think we have to continue to look at the ministry of Jesus and see what He was focused on and look at how He approached these things and continue to see how even the Word was made flesh, that God came and dwelt among us, and so we have to go and dwell among them, that He was ascending disciple. He sent his followers, 12 and 72, and then at the Great Commission, he sent them out, didn't he? He didn't say, you guys sit here on this mountain, and I will send all the world to you. You build a big enough church for them here, and we will fill it for you. He never said that in Matthew 28. He said, go into all the world and make disciples. And so he sent them to go and do that. It's kind of cool that in the book of Acts, he did send all those guys at Pentecost there in Jerusalem, didn't he? With all those languages, and of course, those guys went home, and some cool things happened there, but it just shows us that God is up to so many things, and it's really humbling. And I think sometimes even for parents who have kids who've left, it's important to remember that it's not even necessarily the minister or you or their friend, whoever's going to reach them. Sometimes God just sends somebody into their life out of the blue that we didn't have any idea or could never have planned or coordinated or called that person and said, can you? But it happens. And then they show up, and then what happened? Well, you know, you wouldn't believe it, but I was talking with so-and-so, and such, and I hadn't thought about that person in years. And you see these things happen, and it's so humbling. It's so humbling. So in this whole thing, I'm trying to spark some creativity. I'm trying to spark some ideas. I'm trying to get into that kind of that second-order change of changing some assumptions about the way we see some things. And that's all well and good, but that's not really the most important part. Okay. The most important part is that we have some people who we need to help encourage to have a strong, vibrant, vital relationship with Jesus Christ. That is game number one in this whole thing. And anything that we have to say about strategy or how it goes or what it looks like, it's just because that's what we're trying to do, and that's how it's played out in this particular situation. Okay? And you guys have your stories as well, but it's so humbling. There is no better approach than we can just lift up from one church and slide down the next and guarantee success. But we can guarantee success if God is at the center of what we're doing. Okay? So don't rely on a technique. I wanted just to mention our elders. One reason we started all of this and came to Northwest was our eldership had a vision to see that we had no young families in the church nursery. They had spent money on this nursery and made it really nice, only for there to be no kids to put in it. And they realized that the way to get kids to put in it is to start investing in young people, young adults, and start reconnecting with them. And so they asked us to come on board. And so they wouldn't have to shut their doors in 20 years. I think it was very wise of them, and very, very insightful, foresight of them to do that. And we're willing to start. We didn't all know how it looked, and we didn't know what it was going to require and how it would go. But we keep working, praying, and asking God to help us. And so I wanted to start with just a little bit of some of the aha moments along the way. I think in anything, you kind of start with what you know. And for me, it was, let's just teach a class. And for me, that was, let's have something to invite them to. Let's have an environment that they can feel safe in and authentic in, where they can be listened to, where we can discuss relevant topics. That's kind of where it started for us. Communicate with them, email them, Facebook them, just talk with them in person, call them, whatever it takes. But start making those connections. Start inviting people. Talk to the youth minister. Say, give me a list of whoever's graduated out of the youth group in the last 15 years. Right? And there's your 18 to 33-year-olds. Right? Is that fair enough? Give me the list. Who's still here? You know, who are we connecting with? Put them up on Facebook. I'll let them know that something is happening, that there's something there for them. And then from there, we started thinking, you know, it's got to be more than just Sunday morning at the building, all this. We started planning outside activities. Maybe a Devo, or go to the beach and look around, or do a service project or whatever. But as I said before, it's kind of still me doing it to them and for them. And so we started investing in them and started equipping them, empowering them, motivating them to take it on themselves. Because I started realizing that as long as the control is in my hands, all that I'm going to be able to accomplish is a meat-sized ministry. And I'll tell you what, I don't have the most talent in the world. It's going to be like this. But if I can give it over to talented, influential people who can invest and be involved in it, especially within that age range, but if you don't have them, someone a little beyond that even to come and help give some life to this thing, to people who are magnetic and energetic and loving and the kind of people that you want to be around, put them in that room. Hopefully it's your best Bible teacher. From my point of view, I love Christian education, you know. I would like them to be able to teach the Bible. But you need somebody magnetic who can really pull people in and make people feel welcome and loved and drawn in to this thing. So you got to realize this ministry is bigger than just one person. It takes this group taking on an identity of its own and investing in itself. So we started assigning responsibilities and roles. Devo director, a social director, service director, periodically rotating people through and training and teaching people to do those things and giving them investment in what we were doing. And then you start seeing new people, right? Because now they have something that they feel safe to invite the people they know into. I'll tell you what, a lot of Bible classes, even things I've taught, I'll tell you, let me just speak for myself. Things I've taught in the past, looking back on, I don't even know how safe I would have felt for them to bring their friends into, right? What's going to be said? What are we talking about? What if my friend says this? How are people going to look at them? We say they're safe. Are they safe? We treat them like they're safe. We got to start doing that. We got to create an environment where people are safe to be themselves and ask the questions. Because the only way we're going to reach outside is if we really provide that in a very real way. Otherwise, they won't feel safe to invite. So they took ownership. And then we started sending. I think it's that big aha. It wasn't about big numbers in the class. It was about how many people can we get involved in the mission of God. And kind of get this corporate idea of what success is. My Bible class was 10, and now it's 20, and now it's 40, and now it's 60. Yay, success. But what if that's not success? What if you have 60 people who are just passively receiving information going about their worldly life throughout the week? But we say, wow, Bible class really grew. They're really engaged and everybody must be great. Well, maybe they're not. Maybe they're not. You know. Maybe what if you had 30 people that were really engaged, or 10 people who were really engaged, or wherever you're at, 3 people who were really engaged that could draw people into what they're doing and get them on the mission. And I feel like, I hope we did this, that we gave them room to fail, and that we got over our fear of failure. But you know what? I fail. You know what? You fail sometimes. But somehow with this young group, somehow we've come to believe that their failures are worse than ours. Because they're different than ours. Right? Have you ever seen that experience? That it's like somehow there's this perspective of, well, they do that. Oh my goodness. I mean, it's like, really? But are their failures really any worse than anybody else's in the whole scheme of things? From God's perspective, no. We have to come to grips with that. I love that story. I think it was IBM that had that guy. Somebody correct me if you heard the story. That had the guy who made the investment of, I forget, $10 or $20 million. He made this decision to invest in something over here and failed. Belly up and lost all this money. And the CEO of the company called him in and he said, he's like, man, I'm going to get fired. I'm going to talk to the CEO. I mean, what's going on? This is bad news. I'm going to pack my bags. And he went in. And he's like, okay, you know, I give up firing you. And he's like, why would I fire you? We just invested $20 million in your education. Right? I mean, you just goofed it all up. And I know you're not going to do that. Right? How would we fire you now? I love that. And I think that's such the Jesus model. And we've already talked about the shift on Bible class, creatively thinking through our Bible classes, and also creatively thinking through what venues do we offer people to actually live out the mission of God within the context of the congregation. I want you to hear this up front and center. I'm not saying anything about an unimportant Sunday morning worship or unimportant any of that. I think that's all vitally important. But I think it's in what we do with our time and with the opportunities that we offer. We can't just focus in on just Bible study all the time. I think we need to offer more than just that. And just last year, and we'll offer up some time for questions and answers, just a few notes, if you look in your last pages of your handout, a few notes to the church leaders and a few notes to parents. Church leaders, there's some work that we have to do, and it's going to first and foremost require patience. It takes a lot of patience to talk and deal with people who you don't understand. You don't understand where they're coming from. You have to spend time with them. Listen to them. Give them a voice. And realize that they don't have to be 50 years old to have a leadership or responsibility position in the church. I think we have to create those inroads and opportunities for them to start serving early. One question that I ask young ministers periodically, people that I run into or friends of mine, I'll ask them, why did you choose to do this? I mean, if all these 20s and 30s are gone, and you're in your 20s and 30s, you're not even just that you're not gone, you're preaching. What's different about you? How did you end up here? Why are you doing this? When statistics say not only should you not be a preacher, you should not even be in the building, right? Statistically speaking. And 9 times out of 10, the answer I get is they were given opportunity. They were given opportunity when they were young. And I think the mistake that we make is we have so professionalized all these things that we do that we end up with an auditorium setting where people come in and can passively receive the Word of God, worship can be done to them, for them, and we end up being lazy about some things. And I think that's unfortunate. And I don't think we engage people like we should with opportunity. Again, we limit down to being just your opportunity to serve is to pass the Lord's Supper. No. It's got to be more than that. If the opportunity to serve in Acts was passing the Lord's Supper, praying, and reading Scripture, we would not have made it past chapter 2. Right? They fellowshiped together, broke bread together in their homes, and gladdened your hearts, you know, and all this. And then what? The Word of the God, what? Did what? Spread. How did it spread? If it's just staying in the house. Right? I mean, if it's just what happens in the house, we're done at the end of chapter 2. But there's more to the story, isn't there? And I think we have to reflect that. If our biblical model is the book of Acts, we need to be serious about that. But I think too often, yeah, this part of Acts and these verses and that. And, yeah. There's so much more that's that we need to hear and that we need to participate in. Be willing to be questioned. If they have questions, let's listen. Don't shut them down. Don't destroy them. Be authentic and real. Be authentic and real. If you got sin, it's sin. Okay, we all got it. Not a secret. And they need to see how to reconcile that. God, know what the negotiables and non-negotiables are. And you know what? If we all made our list of negotiables and non-negotiables, probably we wouldn't have 100% overlap between two people. But I think that's something worthy to look at, and that we can stand firm where the non-negotiables are and have flexibility where we need to have flexibility. And we need to have elderships who are willing to give permission in areas of flexibility that we can be creative and try things. And we need to invest in this. I would say for a lot of congregations, maybe need a budget line, even if we don't have a staff person budget line for 20-somethings. It might be helpful to put a little money into what we're doing, because once you put money on something, what happens? Where does it get?
The A word.
Attention. Once you put money on something, it gets attention. What's happening over? Understand? That's just the way it works. That's just the way it works. And so if it's $50 a week, $10 a week, $100, whatever it is, you find somebody who's magnetic and active and engaged and who loves the Lord and invest in that person. Invest in that person. And say, we value what you're doing so much, we're willing to pay you $100 a week, $5,000 a year, whatever it is, whatever. Because I'm telling you, say, well, we don't have $5,000. We're talking future of the church here. I mean, we'd spend $5,000 on the auditorium in a heartbeat to update something, right? I mean, we're talking about equipping our kids, right? You get an amen?
Amen.
We gotta get to work on these things. I almost apologize that I'm making it sound so complicated. I'm just trying to hit different people where you're at. Some of you are a little further along than others, and I'm trying to give you something, and some are at the beginning, and I'm trying to give you something. I really hope it doesn't sound all that complicated. It's really not. In the notes, a few notes for parents here. Don't let guilt defeat you. Don't let guilt defeat you. Pray for them. Be loving to them. Be loving to them. Be authentic. Make them feel loved, valued, protected. Be willing to address any of your own past brokenness that is there. They already know about it. Right? They already know. Dirty laundry, and they know about it. But have you addressed it? Have you addressed it? Create a safe environment for them where they can ask their questions. Don't run them off. You know that God knows. Like we said before, it's amazing how God can connect things that we can never plan. It's very humbling. Be patient and willing to listen. I just want to close, before we do question and answer for a few minutes, just with saying there is a great hope here, right? Good news in a broken world. This word is broken. Maybe there's not a better word. Maybe the word hurt. And Chuck Clark used that word. There's a book called Hurt. If you want to learn more about their brokenness, you can read that book from the Church 2.0, but they're broken. And they need someone to come alongside them, put an arm around them, and just walk with them through life, difficult, difficult life, so they can have identity, they can belong, they can feel love, and they'll listen. And they'll listen. So what questions do you guys have?
What you mentioned about the professional aspect of our world is brought into the church, and this is all we hear. Even at home, you cannot do a job unless you call in a professional. But the handyman, I say, can do a little of all of it most of the time. And in the church, we've got talent there to take over and not call in a professional.
One thing he's been sharing with me is just kind of the approach of training up your own within the congregation to take on leadership and ministry roles, preaching, teaching, evangelizing, and those sorts of things. And I think that is a little missing component to what we're doing, is really equipping our kids. I think Lads to Leaders has made an attempt to do that, but I think it's still to be disconnected a little bit from the specifics of the mission. Memorizing scripture is great, giving speeches is great, and all those things, but how do those kids see how those things translate over into their real life is something that we have the responsibility to help them see. That's good.
do you see or you, do you experience, I mean, a lot of this is discussing really in the church context, but in a corporate setting. You see, how does this work in establishing beachheads in the community and other places? I guess I think about some places I run into young people who may not ever come to church building for all the reasons that we're discussing. Do you have much experience in that area? Or is it more of just you get your young people to get there, you get their friends? Is that really kind of what you're, has most been, I'm just asking.
Yeah, I think we tend to break things down into a traditional model, an attractional model, or a missional model. And I think, and like Gareth had mentioned previously, we think that consumerism is the traditional or the attractional. If we build it, they'll come. If we make it good enough, they'll come and be a part. I think you do have to have, I think when the church is engaged in the mission, I think there's going to be a certain part of the world that will be attracted to that.
Okay.
But I don't think you can rely solely on that either. I think that we have to equip and encourage people as they're going out into the world to be cognizant to make those types of connections. I mean, like our college class at times, we meet at Starbucks for Bible class and discuss the Bible right in the middle of all these people who, what's that? What's going on over there? And then they talk, they actually are caring people. What do you know? And they're studying their Bible. You know, how cool is that? And so I think creativity and having a little bit of freedom to try some of those things is key. We probably haven't done that in that context probably as much as we should, but that would be a good next step. Yeah. That's good. Do you have any other thoughts on that? Maybe you thought about that quite a bit.
Well, I don't know. I just know that the lady that serves me a Frappuccino is someone that I've been praying for, and I just thought, was just wondering. Well, it's actually a latte, but who's getting paid?
Related to that, you gave the illustration. Was it you that gave the illustration, or maybe another class I was in, where we were talking about the crossing the river and building the bridge? Was that your?
Yeah.
Okay, good. That scared me for a second there. Is there a possibility that getting them to our side of the river is unnecessary? Is there a possibility that we could build a church on their side of the river?
I guess it depends on how you define the island.
House church? Is that what you mean? House church?
Yeah, I mean, to me it depends on how you define the island. If the mainland is the church building, then I would say yes. If the mainland is are God's people and the island is, they've gone off to find identity in a whole other group and they've become syncretistic and smorgasbord their religion of Buddhism and Hinduism, and you see this happening, if that's what's happening on the island, I would say we engage them there, but we hope to bring them out of, we hope that they'll see the disconnect between those different belief systems and put their faith solely in Christ. I mean, I don't think you try to, you wouldn't want to leave them stuck there, you know what I mean? So I think it depends on how you define that, the island, and what those boundaries are in my analogy. That's the hard part with the analogy, some of the definitions sometimes.
So let me take it out of the analogy. I think there's a real possibility that what we think of as church, songs and prayers and communion in a church building, is the hut that we've built. I'm not really thinking, I guess I probably even missed the island. I'm thinking more opposite sides of the river. I think there's a real possibility that they are not ever going to connect to what we think of as church. And there's going to be worship and service and discipleship that doesn't look anything like what we've grown up with it looking like, but is nonetheless authentic worship and discipleship. And so there's a possibility that we might need to let them create or help them or enable them or empower them or guide them into creating something that looks very different than what we are used to seeing.
Well, that's not new. It's been that way from the very beginning. We assume that the way we do things is the way it's always been done, but it's not. And the things we do were innovative at some point in time, but now we think they're old. Some of the things we do were, you're going to do what? And I would say, you don't do that. So innovation will always take place, and I think we have to understand, again, negotiables and non-negotiables, and be flexible where we can be flexible, and be firm where we need to be firm. But are they coming, you know, are we trying to draw them to a building or into a relationship with Christ? is our first and foremost question, and that alleviates a lot of my concerns. If I talk with them and I'm hearing that they're really seeking Christ, it's just maybe their faith is not expressed in all the traditional forms that I may understand it to be. I'm not quite as worried about God's power to save that person. You know what I mean? Based on, well, they're not towing the line on every little way I see everything. I'd rather the New Testament define my non-negotiables. Like, what was non-negotiable for Paul? I'm willing to make that non-negotiable for Christ or whoever. You know what I mean? But so many times we make everything non-negotiable, so then everything must look like just the way we do it. But just the way we do it is not everything we do has a biblical basis. So I think we have to try to pull that apart. I appreciate what you're saying. I think you're on something.
Kind of what you're saying makes me think of the Celtic form of Christianity versus the Roman form of Christianity. That when you, instead of building your cathedral and telling people they have to come here and learn how to be a proper person, and once they do that sufficiently, then you fellowship them. Versus the Celtic is to go across to where they are, live among them, be the church with them, help them do things with them.
Incarnational ministry.
And you become the church. And then, of course, then you start building buildings or whatever. But, you know, this starts expanding. I don't know if that's what you're getting at. That's what it made me think of.
Yeah. Well, people use the word organic.
Yeah.
And I think that shows up in many ways. I think we have to be open to ways that are justifiable, you know. I mean, we look at facility issues and say, well, we need $3 million more dollars to build space for these. Well, why not put them in homes? I mean, what's our end up on? We already have $3 million of mortgages of homes that people are paying every month that could be used for that. We needed to really take on three, you know. And I'm not opposed to buildings. I just think they need to have the right purpose and be used for the right reasons. But I think sometimes we just don't think as creatively as we could. I think we're too inside the box, and we get kind of stagnated into a certain way of thinking that's ascriptural on certain issues. It's just not addressed in Scripture on certain things. And so some view silence is prohibitive. Is that scriptural?
Can I jump back in? I don't want to cut other people off. I love the fact that you brought up Celtic Christianity. I think it was Peter Rollins who took the, and you may have read this already, this is part of that second order change thinking for us. We typically think of discipleship as believe, behave, and belong. And he says Jesus and the Irish did it exactly the opposite. We belong first, then we begin to behave like those who believe, and then we come to believe. And that's what you're talking about in this shift. Whereas we've pretty much traditionally expected people to at least behave like us first. But we kind of thought we wanted them to believe and then behave, and then we would accept them as part of the fellowship. You're saying make them belong first. Let them learn our behaviors by hanging out with us, and then let them come to believe as we believe.
Yeah, that's perfect. That's so beautiful. If you think about a 25-year-old who's left the church, who has gotten into connections, friendships with people outside the church of whatever background, that's going to be the process that most of them are going to engage that world with. Is they find some people that they feel like they belong with, then they start engaging into their belief systems and behaviors. And so if it works that way, I can't help but think it works the other way as well. I mean, I think that's where we're at, is we have to create safe environments and opportunities for people to feel that love and that safety and that security. But we're so quick to throw up walls of separation, even amongst Christians, much less Christians in the world. And so I think we do ourselves a detriment. I think that's a wonderful point that you both made. Yeah. Anybody else?
I appreciate the large amount of work that you put into the handout and the presentation very much. And I just know in our context, in a small church, that I think one of our interests me, and I'm a simplistic person, so I guess this may sound very simple, but I think that we have tried too much to try to have a church presence, such as a Sunday school class for this particular age group, that hasn't been received well because they don't come to Sunday school. And the thought that, well, that's because they don't have a class. You know, you kind of approach something like that. So what if you had the class and they still don't come? If you build it, they might not come. But I think that one of the things in my world is that everybody has let busyness overtake them to such an extent that there's no margin left, there's no elbow room, and what our young couples, my belief is they need to spend some time just having some fun together and getting to become friends. They're great people. They're stretched out in 40 different directions. I don't even know how they do everything they do. You know, I'm amazed. But I'm not a party planner or anything like that, but I just think that would be, to me, if they could grow closer together and strengthen each other just by virtue of their friendship, that's a big step for discipleship and helping them put down some roots together.
I was mentioning to Mike on the break that there was a time in the last year or so that with us having children, maybe the last 2 years, with us having small children and everything, that something's got put on hold as far as coordinating things and keeping accountability of what's going on, assigning leadership roles, and some of those things kind of got put on hold for a while, and we had this absence of planned activity for a period of time. But what was interesting to me about it was, if you went and talked to people in the group, you were finding out they were still spending time with each other because they wanted to do that. And you weren't going to stop them from doing that. And so they didn't care if it wasn't something on the schedule. They were still getting together and going out to eat or going to each other's homes or your life group or whatever it was. You'd hear, oh, we had dinner with so-and-so. And it's like, oh, that's awesome. It wasn't on the schedule. That cool. I didn't want to do that.
Right.
No, isn't that cool?
Getting to that place is tough. When,
right.
Especially with newer people that really don't know each other very well. I'm reminded of the J.B. Hayes life group in Kosciuszko, Mississippi, in the church there. And J.B. Hayes has been dead now many years. His life group still meets. they abandoned life groups a long time ago, but their group still meets because they love each other and they're just not going to quit meeting together.
I know, looking back over my lifetime, the church, they've missed both, some way or other, and I don't know, I don't have the answer really, but I could see that the material that they was taught wasn't the right material, whatever it is, I don't know, it was be there 3 times a week. Like I've said before, the only drug problem I had, you probably heard this, my parents drove me to church 3 times a week. And so, but there was something missing, I believe it was, that didn't, we wasn't instilled the right thing.
Well, I think some of it just comes out of our own heritage and our own background, that sometimes we don't make adjustments fast enough. And one of those would be, 50 years ago, the whole denominational conversation of trying to convert Baptists to the Church of Christ and things like that was a large part of the conversation. And I wasn't alive at that time, so I'm very open to being corrected on this. But my own understanding, it just seems like our focus there got a little off. And we stopped looking so much out beyond. You know, people who already believed in Jesus, they just didn't believe this about this and that about that. We stopped seeing the mission field of the lost. We just kind of assumed, well, everyone knows about Jesus. Everyone's a Christian. And now we live in a world where, well, now they're Hindus and Buddhists. I mean, there's so much information being disseminated in our world, and people have availability to relationships across the world. I mean, it's changed rapidly. And if we just stand with our old assumptions on some of these things, we just will fade away. I think we have to make some adjustments And that doesn't mean that we give up on certain of our non-negotiables or things like that. I just think we have to be cognizant that the mission field is not just this group or that. There's a lot of people who never even heard of Jesus or who heard of him and got really burned. Instead of, well, they still love Jesus, but we disagree on this, let me win you over. I think we have to see a lot broader than that.
I believe we've, in the past, talked too much about negatives instead of positives. In other words, to other people, the people down the street, our neighbors. We wanted to dot every I and cross every T. Exactly. And if we didn't do that, you was on the other side.
Yeah, and out of that, kind of the wrong focus, wrong topics, is we kind of got fixed into communicating about ecclesiology. How do we do church? This group does church like this, and they do church like this, but we do church like this. And in that, we got so inward focused, I think, that we stopped looking out. And so I think our conversation is shifting from ecclesiology to missiology. What is the mission of the church? How is God redeeming this world? How do we partner with him in that redemption process rather than just all the how-tos of worship and various things that we've studied for so long? So I'm glad to see that we needed the balance at least. Maybe we swing too far to the mission. And worship, whatever. Maybe we kind of mess that up a little. I'll just say this. I got to get to you, brother. And Aaron is, we have such a hard time with balance, don't we? It just seems like we're so far over here, we say, man, we need to be way over there. We just can't stop the pendulum in the middle somehow. We swing way over to missiology and say, well, forget ecclesiology, whatever on that. We're tired of talking about that. And now our young people don't even know why we do the Lord's Supper every week.
Right.
You know, and so I think we got to get our head on straight and say, let's not just get our pet one or two topics. Let's look at the broader view of Scripture, figure out how we fit into this thing, and get on this mission and get on board. Let's go. Right here
I'd like to say, I think the answer to your question of what was missing, at least when I was growing up, I don't know that people knew that we loved them. And I think as a church, we need to show the world that we love them. And I think that we've failed miserably in doing that. And we've spent our time showing them that they're wrong.
Yeah.
But I think we need to be doing that in love.
We'll do well to do that if we can start with our 20s and 30s. I mean, if they've got tattoos and facial piercings, can you love them anyway?
Well, yeah. It's hard to.
Well, we've said we won't.
No, anyway, can we just love
them? We haven't said it, but we've acted like this, is we won't love you until you become like me.
Right.
And then I can love you.
But that
bridge won't be crossed. You're going to have to just get over that one. That's not a non-good. And I'm not talking about anyone. I got to get there. We're in that time.
Well, we're probably past time.
But, that's okay.
No, I was just wanting to say, now you actually got to it when you were talking. I think that we have to be careful that we don't worry about correcting. We should spend our time trying to correct the past. And I always tell people, we're all broken. So, yeah, things happen that were broken. Let's worry about our future. And so with my kids, I get the opportunity to do it, to show them that it's about loving people, to take my kids to mission opportunities, to have them see that, to incorporate all facets, to make sure, let's just worry about what we do forward. I always, we can spend our lifetime pointing fingers at the past, but we have a choice today and for the future, and that's what you're here to talk about. That's why I love it, because you're talking about 20s and 30s and what's the future, and that's why we came to this class. So you did a great job. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your feedback, comments. Always just trying to reach all of these students and just try to learn from each other. I've learned a lot listening to you guys, and I appreciate that.
I was
going to
say, a lot of what we've learned, and I don't know if this is from my own counseling background, but you can learn so much by asking questions, you know, and not to assume, just to be the teacher and the leader all the time, but what do you need? Or your parents talking about the woman that does the latte for him, you know, like, what's your story? What do you need? What have you been to church before? What was your experience? You know, start with there. Have you heard about Jesus? I don't know if there's people that have just never even heard the name Jesus before, but it's amazing, even in our class, like, what do you need? Or what do you want to study? Or, you know, it's amazing how much stuff you've grown through asking questions.
I did notice you've got Blue Light Jazz on your resource sheet there at the beginning, and I want to make sure everybody's aware the movie's about to be released. He's been doing screenings for 6 months now around the country. Blue Like Jazz. If you haven't read it, you need to. And you're working with 20 and 30 something, you need to read it.
Yeah. The point of putting that book on there is these are books that will help you understand where they're coming from. Let's hear some of them speak to us. Irresistible Revolution, Radical by David Platt, Francis Chan, Crazy Love. Some of these books, you'll kind of hear the perspective. Let's just have a prayer. I appreciate y'all.
Yes.
Lord, we're thankful for our day today. We're thankful for the ways that you challenge us and sharpen us. And we pray that our ministry may become more and more like the ministry of Jesus and not for us just to assume like it already is. And Lord, that we can become more and more like the church that we find in Acts and not just assume that it already is. And Lord, but as Aaron said, not to just dwell in the past and just try to find all these correctives to all of our guilt and issues of the past, that we can find a positive view toward the future, and that we can find a way through all this brokenness that the world is experiencing, that we can bring them reconciliation and hope, that we can help heal them and mend them. And Lord, we want to hear the stories that these 20-somethings want to produce. They want victory, Lord, and it's so exciting and encouraging when we find it, when we can experience it and celebrate it with them. And so we pray that we can get over our fears of failure, that we can get over our fears of letting go of responsibilities and decision-making processes, and just disseminate that out into those hands of those who need to grow and who need that opportunity to learn, to be passionate about you and your kingdom. So God, empower us, equip us, and guide us.